those of you who don't know, that people have asked me during the interview times about the different types of Buddhism in our world today. And you all know that I've for a long time now tried to combine the three main strands of Buddhism, the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. And you know that story. That, to combine them, I take the H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana, and the Yana from Vajrayana. What does that spell? Hahayana, yes. So this is the type of Buddhism you have here. So if anybody asks you what type of Buddhism do you actually hear here in Jhana Grove, it's Hahayana. To enhance one's meditation practice in daily life, how do I handle being around people who use rough language and upset me by toxic remarks? You've got two ears. One is to go in, one is to go out. So please, don't keep the rough language. Let them speak whatever they like. So, as Ajahn Chah said, that you, it's not the language disturbs you. You disturb the language. It's just words, that's all. So don't react. If it's nice words, keep them. If it's terrible words, in one ear, out the other. It's like on this retreat. Any compliments, they come here. Any complaints to Bianca or Dania. So that's the way to live your life. So any sort of rough language, toxic remarks, I pass the buck. Compliments, oh yeah, thank you, I'll keep those. The suttas mention flying as one of the psychic powers. Does this refer to some sort of astral travel, or do they literally mean flying, flying nun? Have you been messing around during the retreat? Is there a flying nun? No, there's flying monks. Yeah, I mean, that's happened. People have actually seen monks flying through the air. One of the famous monks is Ajahn Wen, Lumpu Wen. He became famous in the north of Thailand. He's died now. He became very famous because there was a Thai Air Force pilot who was doing exercises in the north of Thailand, and he saw this monk sitting on a cloud. And that was really weird. And, you know, he saw him very clearly. And so he took the coordinates, and when he landed and had a day off, he searched the area, you know, and around that area, the coordinates where he saw that monk. And asked him, then he's sort of like forest monks with great powers and stuff. And yeah, he found the monk there, exactly as he saw in the cloud. So, he told everybody, and then that monk became very, very famous. I know there's a Burmese monk, and he was actually, because Burma is not sort of as rich as Thailand, so it's actually a train driver saw him. So he's driving on the train somewhere in Burma, and this monk was actually in front of the train. And the train driver sped up, apparently, to try and catch up with this monk, but the monk always kept in front of the train, you know, just, you know, having a bit of a fun and games, a bit of a race, and then the monk went off into the jungle. You know, and not sort of walking, but just floating above the train tracks. So he became famous as well. So those are the flying monks, and I said, yes, it actually happens. But you've got to be very careful, because if you are floating, you have to remember to keep your meditation, because if you're floating up and suddenly forget or get sort of disturbance, then you come crashing down. As one of the great stories, which are in the commentary somewhere, about this one monk. There was a monk, and he was staying in the jungles, in the forest, a long time ago, and a really good meditator, and it just happens naturally. You know, these are some of the things which occur. And so he could actually levitate, and so he was actually, every morning, he would just actually go for an exercise, and fly around the jungle, just, you know, a bit of fun. And a villager saw him. And, of course, one villager told another villager, the villager told the townspeople. Soon it got to the king. And when the king heard about this, he always wanted to see a monk who had psychic powers. Wouldn't you like to see a monk who had psychic powers? Or another with psychic powers? Would you please demonstrate? No, you can't do that. But anyway, so the king sent some minister up to invite him to the palace. And, of course, the monk said, no, I don't want to go into the palace. I'm a forest monk. So when the minister came back the next time, the king sent the army in. And of course, you can't argue with an army. So the monk came back to the palace. The king was very good. In the middle of the palace grounds, he built a nice forest and a nice little hut, just like he had in the jungle. So, you know, he said, well, look, you know, it's like you're in the jungle here. You've got all the nice trees in the palace grounds and a nice little hut there. And you can stay here and just do your meditation, because I really just want to feed you, make good merit, good karma. And also, if there's any questions I like to ask about things, you're obviously very wise. And you can also help me with my meditation. So it was, you know, a decent idea, a decent deal. So for a couple of weeks, you know, the king would feed this monk and ask him questions, and the monk would carry on his routine, always go for a fly around just before breakfast. And it just happened one day, this is the story, I didn't make this up. One day it was one of the princesses brought the food to the monk, and she was drop dead gorgeous. Now even though he was a monk, he was flying around and he saw this beautiful girl. And he had one moment of lust, that's all it took. One moment of, wow, she's hot. And he lost his powers. That's how sensitive they are. So he had to do crash landing. And as soon as he realized just how dangerous it is, you know, in the city with so many temptations, he had his breakfast, packed up his bowl and walked back to his forest. Took him a couple of weeks to get there. And he realized that, you know, if you do fly through the air, you've got to be very careful. One irritation, one bit of lust, one bit of anger, and that's it. Crash landing. So if you do learn how to levitate, please get a crash helmet and some other padding in case you forget to know how to come down again. So yeah, it does actually mean it's actually really flying. Ajahn, sore muscles and tired eyes. What does it mean? It means you should go to bed. Oh, what does it mean to the premeditation stage, Sadhu? Look, if you've really got sore muscles, do some stretching exercises. Is there anyone here who's a yoga teacher? Oh, great, at the back over there. So I don't know if you'd mind just if anyone's got some sore muscles to teach them some quick stretching exercises. Sure. Sure, okay, so anyone who wants to sort of get some stretching exercises, a bit of sore muscles, because you know, some of the yoga exercises, if you really do them, it makes it so easy to sort of do sitting meditation. But you can always do, you know, on the chairs. Those chairs are especially designed, you know, for people who want to meditate sitting down. You know, if, you know, you're very stable, just the ordinary chairs, if you sort of, you know, tend to sort of bend a little bit, just the ones with the armrests, they're supposed to keep you in place. If you still have trouble, we've got ones with seat belts, so you can move over and won't fall off. So, and if it's tired eyes, the tired eyes might mean, if it's not, because you know, you haven't been doing very much, it might mean that you're straining your eyes. Because there's one thing which happens in breath meditation, I have to tell this every time, that a lot of times people focus on the tip of their nose. And when you focus on the tip of the nose, yes, you've got your eyes closed, you think you're just focusing your mind on the tip of the nose, but what your mind looks at, your eyes loosely follow. So what you usually do with your eyelids closed, you're going like this all the time, watching the tip of your nose. No wonder your eyes strain after a while. So if you're the one who asked that question, sort of tired eyes, have you been watching the breath at the tip of your nose? And if you have, that's probably the reason. You know, your eyes have been following your mind, and you've been screwing your eyes down, and your eyes get strained. Which is one of the reasons why it's great not to watch the tip of the nose, but just watch the breath, whatever it happens to be. So you don't really know where the breath is, you just know the breath is happening. And then you don't get sort of, you know, tired eyes or stress around the eyebrows. Ajahn Brahm, even if the mind isn't very still, you can't find the breath and the inner voice is running riot, is it beneficial to keep sitting? The longer you sit, is there some chance of the mind becoming still by itself after it has run out of things to think about? The answer is no. You'll always find something new to think about. There's no end of things to think about. You've been thinking about things how many years now? And you still haven't exhausted them all yet? And you never will. So, one of my stories. When I was 6 years as a monk, I found this beautiful monastery. Now, this was for an English monk. You couldn't get a better monastery than this. It was in the middle of a tea plantation. I had as much tea as I could ever want. That was like paradise for an English monk. That's actually why I became a disciple of, you know, my teacher, Ajahn Chah. Anyone whose surname was Chah was the teacher for me. But anyway, I was in the middle of a tea plantation up in the mountains, perfect place, nice solitude, no one else there. And it was absolutely perfect for meditation. So I was having a good time at first, but then my mind started to get restless. It started to think about all sorts of things. And what happened next was it started to think about what I call unmonkish thoughts. Now, old girlfriends, romance, sex, all sorts of stuff. Now, I've always been a very committed monk. I've never once wanted to even thought of disrobing. I've always loved being a monk since the time I was ordained. And when those thoughts come, I don't want those. Get out of here. But they kept on coming in, and I could not stop them. And after about a few days of this, you can appreciate this, I was going crazy. You know, I never had anyone to talk to, which was a problem. So one morning, in desperation, I went into the main hall. There's always a Buddha statue there. And I just bowed and asked for some sort of inspiration, some sort of help. And the idea came into my mind, let's do a deal. Because I was a Westerner, and Westerners do deals. And the deal was this, that from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. every afternoon, I could think whatever I wanted to do. Sex, weird sex, romance, old girlfriends, anything goes, no barriers at all from 3 to 4 p.m. After that time, before that time, the rest of the day I watched my breath. I thought that was a reasonable deal. Look, mind if you want to play around, okay, 3 to 4 is anything goes time. And I will not stop you, I will not sort of try and resist you at all. The rest of the time you behave. And I thought that was fair. But it never worked out the way I expected it, because it was just as much struggle. Now, I was trying to watch my breath, and all these thoughts would come in. And you try and keep them out, watch your breath, and they just burst in again. And it's just so tiring, as many of you know, trying to control that sort of wandering, thinking mind. But I keep my promises, so when it got to 3 o'clock, I went up to my hut, then against the wall, because I was just really exhausted. I said, okay, mind, you can think whatever you want now. Anything goes. And for the next hour, I watched every breath without missing one. So simple. And that's a true story, and that was really weird. But I learned what letting go was. When I was fighting those thoughts, that's what was feeding them. Every time I tried to keep them out, I was making them stronger. And when I just said, okay, if you want to come in, that's fine with me. 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock, the weirdest sexual fantasy in the planet, come. Another thing came was the breath. It's not really weird fantasy, is it? We're just watching the breath. That's what happened. And that was actually amazing. From that, I realized what letting go is and why controlling and fighting and struggling is the problem. So, you know, if you have a mind, where it's gone here, your inner voice is running right. Is it beneficial to keep sitting? Keep sitting, but the main thing is just, okay, mind, if that's what you want to do, that's fine by me. Don't try and stop it. Let it be. Be kind to it. And when you're kind to it, accept it. Don't be embarrassed. Don't indulge in it, but just let it be. You'll find its energy starts to dissipate. There's no reason for it to do that anymore when you're not fighting. And after a while, you get very, very peaceful and very still. Try that, and you actually learn a lot about the nature of the mind. You control it, you force it, you treat it like a slave to follow your demands, and your slave rebels and throws a tantrum. You treat it with respect and kindness. Mind, if that's what you want to do, fine by me. Then your mind behaves. It's your friend. It wants to look after you. You look after it. So remember, your mind, your breath, whatever it is, it's not your slave, your servant. You tell it what to do, and it throws a tantrum. You're kind to it, and it behaves. That's how you treat your mind. So it doesn't really matter whether you're sitting or whether you're walking. Be kind to your mind. One thing you can do, and the last retreat I suggested this to many people, it works wonderfully well. Just you ask your mind, what do you want to do? It's not what I want you to do, but what do you want to do now, mind? If the mind says, oh yeah, I just want to think, oh, good idea, off you go. And if your mind says, oh, I want to go to sleep, oh, very good, now I'll take you to the bed and I'll put you to bed. Because if you're kind like that, your mind will actually really relax. And you'll be surprised, your mind says, oh, I want to meditate. And then it meditates with you, rather than you forcing it. So ask your mind, what do you want? You want to take a sexual fantasy? Okay, off you go. You want to sort of be dull? Oh, fine. You want to think about the cricket? Oh, great, think about the cricket. I don't know what you think about. But if you're kind to the mind like that, the mind gets very peaceful. Because the restlessness all comes from you fighting. Remember what I said about the cup? You put it down, let it go, become still. You try and hold it still, and it starts to shake. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if reborn into other... Oh, I mentioned this yesterday, but I hadn't fully answered it. If reborn into other higher realms, how does one have access to and continue to practice the Dhamma? Number one, you've got your memory of everything you heard. And even higher beings, they come down and visit. They come listen. I already mentioned the story yesterday about the ghost who sent me email. So if the ghosts have got Wi-Fi, so have the devas. They can actually tune in to the live streaming from our center in Nolamara. You know, Dhammaloka now does live streaming every Friday night talk, Saturday afternoon meditation, and Sunday sutta classes always stream live. So if you know, you can stream it live all over the world, I'm sure the Deva realms also have a Wi-Fi there, they can pick it up too. If we born into lower realms, does one still retain karmic consciousness choice? Or are you stuck until bad karma is exhausted, have to wait until higher rebirth to practice Dhamma? Now, as I said the other day, the idea of bad karma being exhausted. Now, you've got heaps of bad karma, each one of you. You can't exhaust the bad karma you have got. And also, you can't exhaust the good karma you've got. Because this is the truth. Now, if you do one good act of karma, you get it back thousands of times. You know, if you say you give a mango to say, a monk or a nun, you get 1,000 mangoes back. You know, 1,000,000 mangoes or whatever. So this is just an idea. So the amount of good karma you've done, there's no way through the rest of existence you can exhaust all of that. There's just too much of it. And bad karma, you've got so much of it. So why do you get bad karma happening or good karma happening? In all the times, actually, you just have a choice. Your choice is just the way that you resonate. If you're in a good mood, if you're kind, peaceful, gentle, you actually bring up good karma. If you're in a bad mood, negative, then you actually bring up the bad karma. And especially with this thing called guilt. You've all done bad things in the past. Why can't we just let them go? And that's the reason I didn't tell this yesterday. I'm a bit reticent about saying it today, but maybe you can do this tomorrow when the water can be used again. We can flush the toilets. In the last conference I did for this psychology group in Sydney, I told them about the best way of letting go of the past. What you've done which is bad, what other people has done which is bad for you. If you are going to get rid of the awful things which have happened to you in the past or the awful things you have done, every psychologist knows that you have to bring it up first of all. Sometimes people do that in counseling sessions. But here you can do it by yourself. Just write it down on a piece of paper. That's one of the best ways of bringing up the bad things you've done in the past. But my particular slant on that, my addition to that, is the type of paper you write it down on. So you don't write it down on ordinary paper, you write it down on toilet paper. Because that's the sort of paper where such shitty stuff belongs. You know, it's painful stuff, it's rotten stuff which has happened to you, so you write it down very carefully on toilet paper. And once you finish writing it down on the toilet paper, then you read it to yourself, because you've got to face up to it. You've got to know, yeah, this is what I did, this is what someone did to me. And you read it all, first of all, to acknowledge it. And then, once you've acknowledged it, you're not in denial anymore, yes, this happened, then you take it to the place where toilet paper goes. You know, the toilet, you know, the bowl. And you put all of that toilet paper, with all the writing, all the things, bad things you've done, you put it in the bowl. And then you press the button. It's called letting it go. And all the water comes out and it flushes it all away because that's where it belongs. And when it goes down the toilet, that's your letting go. You've let go of the pain of the past. All those rotten things which you did and other people did to you, it goes down the toilet. So that karma does not need to be with you anymore. You can let it go. Yeah? Sorry? Use it first. I suppose if you're into recycling. But no, we've got heaps of toilet paper here. So just write it all down first of all. At least don't use it first before you write it down. That's what somebody told me. There was this one company, and during the financial crisis, they were trying to save costs. So they put a notice up in the toilets, please use both sides of the toilet paper. Well, it's a waste. You're wasting one side all the time, aren't you? But anyway, that's one way of letting things go. And this came up because in Buddhism, a stream winner, a so-one, can never go down to the lower realms. Why not? Stream winners still got lots of bad karma. Why can't they go into a lower realm? And the reason is they've understood non-self enough they can forgive anything. They can take all that bad karma and flush it down the toilet. It's called ahosi karma, karma that was. And you can do that. That's an amazing thing to know, that you can forgive anything. You can let go of it all. And the only reason the bad karma affects you is because of what we call guilt. You own those mistakes. You attach to them. And you punish yourself as a result. And all you need to do is to let it go. Then you don't need to punish yourself anymore. You don't need to go down to lower realms. It's a great thing we call forgiveness. And of course, the hardest person to forgive is yourself. That's why stream winners find that very easy to forgive themselves. So totally let it go. That means they never need to go to the lower realms anymore. And even if you are in the lower realm, if you can have that one moment of forgiveness, one moment of compassion to yourself, then you can't stay in the lower realms anymore. That's how it works. What did the this is a joke. Here we go, great. What did the vegetarian zombie say? I need grace. I need grace. I don't get that. What's the song? I need brains. Brains. I need brains, grains. I'm sure that's a very good joke, but you have to explain it to me tomorrow. How does Sangha deal with jealousy? False view amongst themselves with the lay supporters. Do they create something karma to their minds by doing so? Oh yeah, of course, you know, just Sangha or monks. Sometimes, you know, just like in any other organization, there are monks and nuns who are really advanced and know what they're doing. And there are some monks who are jealous and some monks who get angry. But, you know, most of the time that, you know, we don't judge. So how can you judge another monk? How can you judge another monastery? How can you judge anybody? But sometimes monks do have jealousy. Who's got the biggest temple? Who's got the most disciples? Who is... So should we have a league table? A league table like the most popular monk in the world? Actually, I will not try and become the most popular monk in the world. But I really want to sort of write to the Guinness Book of Records and claim the title as the most humble monk in the world. Because my humility, I would like to shout it out, because if you're humble, you must flout it. So Of course, you can't be the most humble monk, can you? So, yeah, sometimes there's jealousy amongst monks and forced view amongst themselves because everybody is learning. If you're in a school, that means that people still have to learn. That's why they're in a school. So you don't expect people to be perfect in a school. So even amongst the Sangha, the monks and the nuns, yeah, there's sometimes jealousy and there's sometimes forced view and there's sometimes all sorts of stuff. But you acknowledge that, yes, I was jealous. And you learn from it. So what do I do that for? I'm just torturing myself. And instead of doing that, you just let it all go. It's just like jealousy amongst the yogis. Because at the end of the retreat, I always want to sort of point out who got jhanas and who didn't get jhanas. She got jhanas. That's really unfair. This is her first retreat. I've been coming here for years. No way can she get jhanas. That's absolutely impossible. It's amazing how much spiritual jealousy there can be. And that is one of the reasons why, if you do get any attainments or you do get anything, please keep it quiet. Don't go broadcasting it to other people. Especially don't go and tell your husband or your or anybody else. Maybe your teacher, but don't tell anybody else. Because otherwise the jealousy sometimes does come. And that's really very unskillful. So just keep it quiet. That's why as monks and nuns, we're actually taught not to let people know sort of whether we're enlightened or not. Because sometimes it does give rise to jealousy, and it also does give rise to like hierarchies. You know, yeah, I'm not going to go to those nuns over there. They're hopeless. These monks, look at them, sitting very, very straight. They're really good. Not those nuns. Or for all those Dhammasara nuns. I mean, they really work hard. Not those lazy fat monks down at Bodhinyana. So that's very, 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 very unskillful. So like real sort of wisdom shows compassion to all beings, no matter where they are, enlightened, unenlightened. We treat everybody the same. And that's why even our robes, you see, they're exactly the same. You don't get a different colour if you become enlightened. You don't get sort of little stripes, you know, one stripe for stream winner, you know, two for once returner, three for non-returner and a crown. Up there for, you know, for an arahat. You know, you don't get sort of, you know, other little medals for psychic powers. You know, this medal is to show you can fly. This medal is to show you can read people's minds. We don't do things like that. So, you know, every monk looks exactly the same. And that's actually quite beautiful and brilliant in the Sangha. Yeah, we, you know, we do sit in different levels sometimes, but other times you don't know who's who. And that's very, very good. If you could provide other examples of substitution behavior you describe when dealing with stillness in meditation, I refer to substitution behavior we can also apply in our everyday life, family and work, when our fault-finding radar is full on and on duty. I just have to be intuitive, adaptive, and just resourceful to substitute. You know, for example, if you get sort of really, really angry, just, you know, substitute the image of the person you're angry about to yourself by looking in a mirror. And just see what you look like. I read a story about the Buddhist school, and the teacher told little Johnny, he said, look, you know, I was taught by my teacher, you know, if you're angry like that, you know, then your face gets stuck in that position, you get angry. And little Johnny looked to the teacher and said, well, at least you can't say you weren't warned. Kids are very, very cheeky. But and if you look at yourself in a mirror when you get angry, of course, then that sort of makes you realize that when you get angry, you're always looking at the object of your anger. You're not looking at who's getting angry, at yourself. And you're not realizing just how much it's hurting you. It's his fault, it's her fault. You're looking out there. You're not looking at what it's doing to you, which is not really worth it. So a little substitution of the object when you get angry. If you have lust, you see somebody you really, really, really like them. What do you look at? You look at the most attractive part of their anatomy. And so you substitute that for the most unattractive part of their anatomy. So instead of looking at their beautiful hair, you look at, you know, the content of their nose. You see their beautiful lips. You look at the saliva inside, or the bits of thing between their teeth. You can substitute that. That is what we teach monks and novices to do. Because last week we had an ordination. Around the back over there. A novice ordination. And we gave him the five things, the five meditations. Hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. And we're taught as monks, novices, you know, male and female, that, you know, the first weeks of monastic life, he's a young man. How old are you, 22, 23? 22. He's still got the hormones and the stuff going through his body. So he sees a beautiful girl come into the retreat centre. So what does he do? What he does, he remembers the hair of the head. That's all dead. Because the roots are alive. That's underneath. Hair of the body, the same. Your skin. That's all dead stuff. Because, you know, you're a doctor. The alive part of the skin is just under the surface, a millimetre or two. The teeth. That's all dead because the roots are underneath. The nails are the same. This is all dead. You can't see the roots. So when he sees this beautiful supermodel come into the monastery, all he sees is dead hair, dead skin, dead teeth, and dead nails. Who would want to kiss that? Yuck. Who would want to stroke dead hair? That's like touching a corpse. Have you ever touched a corpse? Do you like touching corpses? If you are, you're weird. But that's a way of substituting. You know, just so it gets away from any sort of lust. Or even actually any discrimination, male, female. You look deep inside, you substitute the body for the person inside. So there's not a male, there's not a female, there's a person. So it's an amazing way you can overcome some of the prejudices, some of the defilements, by substituting the normal image which you see by something different. If you've got anger, you see the worst part of the person. Substitute the best part of them. If you've got lust, it's the most attractive part. Substitute a part which isn't attractive. Just to balance it. If you've got discrimination, say you don't like, say, indigenous aboriginals or something, transfer that image to something else. You know, to something else about them, which is inside, their blood, their bones, their feeling of pain. And you can't have discrimination anymore. Substitute. And then you find you can have a much easier life. And if, you know, someone really upsets you, substitute yourself that maybe you said that before. So you can be in their shoes and understand why they think that way, why they say such things. And then, by substituting, you find you get much more peace and understanding in life. That makes sense? Okay. Dear Ajahn, why do some of us feel that we are different from other people? Could it be ego, rebelliousness, different experiences? Many thanks. Do you all remember that life of Brian? When? How many of you didn't see Life of Brian, that great religious movie? Who didn't see it? Wow, you've missed out in life. Because it was a Monty Python movie where they took a satire on the life of Jesus. And Brian was like Jesus. And he's supposed to be a Messiah, a Savior. And he wasn't. They were just looking for someone to be a Messiah. It just happened to be him. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And then they asked him, all these thousands of people, please tell us something inspiring and deep. And Brian, just this ordinary guy, said, you're all different. And then this little guy said, I'm not. The only one who said that. So, why do some of us feel that we are different from other people? It's because you don't know other people. When I started being a teacher and people came up to me and told me their problems, the first time someone asked me a problem, I thought, that's really interesting. The second time, I've heard that before. The third time, here we go again. That's basically what it is. You know, maybe you think that your problems are totally unique in this world, but unfortunately they're not. Exactly the same as everybody else's. And it's humbling, but it's also reassuring as well. There's nothing wrong with you. You're just a human being like everybody else in this planet. Your problems, if you really talk to other people, they're basically essentially the same as other people's problems. And that's why you can be at peace with yourself. You know, one of the great things to know in life is nothing wrong with you. I mean, there's nothing wrong with me. And then you can be at peace with yourself. Ajahn Brahm, thank you for facilitating massive changes in me. Unfortunately, now my boyfriend thinks I'm crazy. Example A, becoming overwhelmed with peace and bliss after a beautiful present moment awareness minute in the kitchen whilst cooking dinner. I was filled with joy and I cried. When I asked why I was crying, I could only say, life is just so beautiful. Thank you. Wow, that should be a turn on for a guy. That was brilliant. After a while, it just starts to creep up on him. So I mean, you start first, and he really gets interested in that. Because if anybody sees anybody else feeling really peaceful and happy, we want to know why. We want some of the same. So after a while, your boyfriend will think, gee, I mean, how come you got so happy? How come you changed? How come you're so peaceful? And he'll start coming on to meditation as well. That's just what happens. There was this Sri Lankan guy here in Perth. He was working in some big government place in Perth. I'd better be careful, otherwise you'll find out who he is. And he told me he had a boss from hell. And this guy would only come to the temple in Nolamara once a year, Waisak. You know that he called the Waisak Buddhist. The Waisak is the holiest day of the Buddhist year. He'd just rock up to the temple once a year, you know, because his wife told him to. And he thought that's what being a Buddhist was. So he was like an engineer. And his boss, this Australian Caucasian, was a very, very angry man. In 3 months, he changed into being very peaceful, enormous changes in the boss. And he was just a kind, really good boss. And this guy told me, he said he wanted to work harder for his boss. Now, once his boss was being kind and being civilized. But he couldn't help but ask his boss, he said, how come you changed? What have you been doing? And his boss said, I found this amazing Buddhist temple in Nolamara with these great teachers. Oh, and I've been doing meditation there and it's wonderful. And this Sri Lankan guy said, that's my temple. But because he was like a born Buddhist, he never realized what was going on there. He just come for the ceremonies and the rituals, and he never realized there was anything else to this meditation and all his teachings. And once he saw how these teachings and meditation changed his own boss, and saw how in 3 months it changed his boss totally around, that's when he started coming regularly. And that's what can happen to your boyfriend. When he really sees the changes, he wants some of it. So he'll start getting interested as well. Salutations. That's very nice. You forgot to the master. Oh, you don't need to say that. To stop inner comments and thoughts. Mantra, you said. Can you use one thought instead? Repeating a mantra, I feel you create more noise and effort in creating words and introducing something unnatural. I like doing it for a short while, but for ages, is it a bit not sure? Some mantras have given me some benefit, though. Thanks. You can make up your own benefits. Long ones, short ones, or just one word ones. I never mentioned that my favourite mantra, which I've used to great benefit for people in Australia, not Om Mani Padme Hum, not sort of may all beings be happy and at peace. My favourite mantra is as you breathe in, you say the word to yourself, shut. As you breathe out, up. Shut. 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 And listen to the space between the words. Shut is finished and up hasn't begun yet. In other words, play around. And actually, it works because it's telling you to shut up, and after a while, you get the message. You shut up. So, experiment, invent your own ones. Seriously, that's one lady did a very nice mantra with the breath. Breathing in, she breathed in peace. Peace. Breathing out, letting go. Breathing in, peace. Breathe out, let go. And that worked very well. So you can innovate and create your own mantra. Be in present moment, you said, not in past and future. But if you are thinking about past, isn't that those thoughts of present moment experience? Similarly, the future. If you are paying attention, that is, would this be a starting point on one of them? Yeah, I suppose so. Because, you know that you're thinking about the past now. Okay, that'll be okay. But if you really notice it's now, then the past usually disappears. The whole point is the past is this huge reservoir of things to distract you. And the future is even more big. What may happen in the future is just so uncertain. There's just so many scenarios. That's why people write all these books and prognoses of what might happen next. People like Nostradamus. Nostradamus couldn't even predict his own death. He didn't know when he was going to die. Just like all these other people, they make all these predictions, and no one knows what's going to happen next. So, those two big reservoirs of busyness, the past and the future, please let them go. And so you can have some rest and some peace, for goodness sake. And you're in a place here where you don't have to worry at all about the future or the past. And that's actually, when I was a monk in Thailand, it was brilliant. It got to the point that because there was no newspapers, there was no radio, there was nothing at all, and I didn't know the date, I didn't know the year. Every day was just a new day, and I didn't know whether it was 1970 this or 1980 that. And that was a wonderful experience, and I'm not exaggerating, I didn't know what year it was, let alone the month or the day. And it never made any difference, it made life much more peaceful. So the past and the future, and all these dates, you've got a few days here where you don't have to worry about that at all. You can just be and get rid of all this prison of time. Oh, they got on here, joke only for personal use, don't have to read out. Is that fair? It's not fair, okay. A man went into a bar and ordered a drink. Apart from the bartender, he was the only one in there, and he was enjoying his drink in silence, when a voice says, "Ooh, nice shirt." The man looks around, but he couldn't see anyone, so he shrugs his shoulders and keeps drinking. A few minutes later, again, the man hears a voice. This time it says, "Ooh, nice shoes." He looked very hard, but couldn't see anyone. So with another shrug of his shoulder, he orders another drink. When a few minutes later, the man hears a voice say, "Ooh, nice tie." He asks the bartender, "Look, I can't take it anymore. Where is that voice coming from?" The bartender says, Oh, that. You see those peanuts over there? They're complimentary." That's bad karma. Complimentary peanuts in the bar. Okay, complimentary means giving compliments but also for free. Very good, thank you so much. When the mind becomes still and silent, a shape appears and then keeps disappearing into itself, a bit like disappearing down a tunnel. If the word is kept on the breath seems hard to find. No, just in this meditation, when it gets to a certain point and the breath vanishes and you start to see these nimittas, I'll talk about them later on. So if the breath has disappeared, the nimitta is trying to get up, don't do anything, don't try and go back to the breath, don't go looking for anything, just stay where you are, be in the present moment, just be still and just see what happens. Just wait in the silence. Enjoy it. So wait, don't be so impatient. It's good stuff. Well done. Thank you for the joy and inspiration that you bring to us. I'm in desperate need of a lesson in bowing. Please can you teach why, when and how? It feels awkward to join in bowing when I do not know what it is all about. Okay, a lot of people do things they don't know. They don't know at all what they're up to, what they're doing, and they just do it anyway. So it's very good to teach people where all these customs come from. For example, when I was last in Singapore, I've seen many people in Chinese temples, and you may have seen them as well. They go into the temple with a whole bunch of joss sticks, and they go shaking it like this before they put it in the joss stick holder. You know, why do they do that? And I'll tell you why they do that. It is because the Chinese people, they learn that from their grandma. The grandmother takes them into the temple. You know, when you're a very small kid, and the grandmother sort of shows you what to do. So it's like Sri Lanka as well. You know, your grandma usually takes you to these temples. But the point is, in the Chinese tradition, when the grandma takes you into the temple, she's got Parkinson's disease. That's why she does that. And you think that's what you're supposed to do as well. So these little kids also do that. They haven't got Parkinson's disease, but they're just following their mum. That's where it comes from. All the grannies with Parkinson's in the past, and you haven't got it, but you still do it. Shoes. Why do people not bring shoes into the Buddhist temples? I'll tell you why. Because sometimes some monks, like yours truly, tells very bad jokes. So you've got nothing to throw at him. That's why you keep him out there so there's no ammunition. But for bowing. Now the reason we bow is because it's good exercise for the tummy muscles. Because in Buddhist temples we all have such delicious food, we can put on weight very easily. So by bowing, you're actually getting the weight off your tummy. Now that's not really the reason why we bow. The main reason why we bow is a good thing to ask. When I bow, I don't bow to a statue. I bow to what it represents. And for a long time now, I bow to virtue. Because virtue, goodness, trust, honesty, that's really important in my life. And when I see it in other people, I worship that. I respect virtue enormously. So the first time I bow down to virtue. The second time I bow down to peace. Peace inside my own mind and my own life, and peace in the world. Because that really is something just I want to generate inside myself and in others. That's just an important thing. I worship peace. And the last time I bow down to compassion, to kindness. Because that really is worth worshipping. You see kindness in this world, and it's such a beautiful thing. It makes this life happy and beautiful. So I bow down to those three things, virtue, peace, and compassion. Sila, Samadhi, Panya in Pali. Well, Panya, but compassion is not really Panya, but it's included in wisdom. And what that means is every time I bow down, mindfully I remember virtue, peace, compassion, and those qualities then grow in me. I'm just reminding myself how important they are. And when you remind yourself of what's really important in life, you know, every time you bow, then those things grow. So when you're bowing down, bow down. If you want to do what I do, bow down to virtue, peace, and compassion. If you've got something else which you really love, you like so much, you want to increase in your own life and in other people's life, then bow down to those. And then the bowing becomes a very beautiful training, not just an empty ritual. Next question. Retreat time is the best time of the year. Thank you so much. Not retreat time, but now time is the best time of the year. It's the only time I've ever got. Why is pointing your feet towards the monks or Buddha statue considered a sign of disrespect? Because people have bad smells in their feet. Now, it was considered a bad sign because of the tradition in India at that time. Heads were high, feet were low. So pointing your feet at somebody was just a way of showing disrespect. It was like the one finger sign. Why is putting one finger up disrespectful? You know, the one finger, you know, giving people the finger. Why is that disrespectful? It's just the custom, isn't it, to be disrespectful. There's nothing wrong with putting a finger up. It's just a finger, that's all. But because we all agreed that that is the sign of disrespect, that's why it's a thing which you shouldn't do. But pointing the feet is just like giving people the finger in India. That's why it's disrespectful. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. So, you know, these days, if you're sitting there and pointing the finger, giving me the finger or pointing the feet, I don't get upset. So it's just custom, that's all. Try it. Point the feet at the Buddha and see if the Buddha objects. If he doesn't say anything, doesn't mind. What is the karmic cause for homosexuality? That's so hard. Isn't there no real karmic cause? It's just some people are homosexual, some people are heterosexual. And you know, those of you who've known me for a while, I was heterosexual before I became a monk. I've always stood up for the homosexuals. You know, once, you know, when somebody reported in the local papers here that the Dalai Lama said you can't be a Buddhist and a homosexual, period. That was reported in the Telegraph in England many years ago. It's reported here, and you know, some of my members here who are homosexual, who are very, very well-loved Buddhists, and they said, is this true? And I said, no, it isn't. They said, can you do something about it? So I wrote to the newspaper and put a letter saying, unfortunately, the Dalai Lama's wrong in this one. There's nothing in Buddhism at all to actually discriminate in any which way against homosexuality. Nothing in there at all. In fact, quite the opposite. May all beings be happy and well. All beings, no matter who they are. And so I wrote that in the newspaper, and it got all these homosexuals came, thank you so much, Ajahn Brahm. At last there's one religion which accepts us and respects us and stands up for us. And so as a result of that, I was really, really proud. I got my invite to the Gay Pride breakfast that year. And I very happily went along there. It was really good. All the gay people there, the gays and lesbians, and now I got invited along there. And when I gave a little speech, I said, actually, I am more deviant than all of you here. All you gays and lesbians and bisexuals, I'm celibate. So I told a few of those. I said, on the next gay and lesbian Mardi Gras, I want my own float. For celibate rights. You could have questioned them, actually. Sorry? No, he didn't, but his supporters did, and they said, no, you can't say the Dalai Lama's wrong. And he said, but eventually, you know, I really objected to that. Look, nobody is a pope, not even the pope's a pope, no one's infallible. Just because the Dalai Lama says it doesn't mean you can't question him. And he would allow that as well. Even the Buddha said, question, just because I say it doesn't mean you have to believe it. So question. If I say it, please question me, because I may say it wrong. I may have the wrong idea. You may misunderstand what I say, mishear what I say. So don't take anyone to be the authority. But, you know, eventually that just people just understood, yeah, you know, the Dalai Lama, he'd misinterpreted something. So it's wonderful, because once there was this guy I met in a talk over in Perth, and he was maybe in his 60s, he said he was a leader of the gay and lesbian community here in Perth, and he complimented me on my attitude in my talk, and then the words he said I will never forget till I die, because he said it was such pain. He said religion has been very cruel to us, and he really meant it, and you could actually feel, you know, the pain which he had endured in his life as a homosexual from religion. And I felt embarrassed, ashamed that I was a religion. I was part of a religion, a leader of a religion, but at least Buddhism will never do that. So gays and lesbians, homosexuals, everyone's invited, because we really need everybody. We're that desperate. Anyway, that was just a joke. Dear Ajahn, you are sweet. Yeah. Whoever wrote that has got great sort of sensibility and judgment. What? I told you I was the most humble monk in the whole world. Guinness Book of Records, humility. What can one do when fear is being inflicted onto the innocent one from the lay sangha in the form of blame, verbal harassment, anger control, out of protection? When fear is being inflicted onto the innocent from one, the lay sangha, from the lay sangha, or from the lay stroke sangha in the form of blame, verbal harassment, anger control, out of protection. If someone is blaming you, verbal harassment, anger, control, projecting anything, that's not really a Buddhist. I don't know who they are, but that's not a good monk or a good nun, it's not a good lay person. Those are people who just are crazy. So if you are being harassed, blamed, remember what I said yesterday, if they call you a dog, look at your bottom, see if you've got a tail. If you haven't got a tail, you're not a dog, no problem at all. So you can get angry, you can get harassed. You know, you all know that after the Bhikkhuni ordination, I was harassed. But you know, you just look at your tail. No, I haven't got a tail there, so it's no problem. You just take it and just let it wash over you. What you can do, as the Buddha once said, imagine that you are a lotus flower. It's a beautiful, pure lotus flower. And imagine that's you, because that's who you really are. And people can urinate on a lotus flower. But all the urine just goes off, and it doesn't leave any trace. They can shit on you, and all the shit rolls off, because the lotus has this incredible way of just everything falls off it, and it leaves no residue. If they shit on you, if they defecate on you, all that rotten stuff leaves no residue. You remain, you keep your purity and your fragrance. So think of yourself like a lotus. And then when people do these things to you, it just rolls off you, like urine off a lotus flower. It's a nice little way of thinking about it. So that's one thing you can do, do the lotus imagination. Could you please repeat the mantra clearly and slowly you said this morning for when you want to get space between your words? Which one was that? That's this morning, that's a long time ago, I live in the present moment. Was it the Om Mani Padme Hum? Om. Mani. Mani. Padme. And then Hum. That's what it is. Otherwise known as, oh money, pay my home. That's the old joke. I think it would be a good idea to launch a recipe cooking book with all the good food recipes we have received. The title could be 9 Days Retreat, the complete cookbook for a happy meditator, enlightenment not included. Thanks also to the cooks looking after us. You've only had 2 or 3 days yet. 2 meals. 2 meals is not enough for a cookbook, unless you include the cheese and the chocolate and the cups of tea and the sweets. In there. Yeah, maybe. Dehayajan, can you tell us about Mara? Thank you. Mara is this very dodgy person. And he is this interesting part about Mara. In Buddhist cosmology, Mara is the head of one of the highest heavenly realms, the realm of those who control or wield power over other people's creations. In other words, the control freak in chief. And it's an amazing thing, an amazing insight of the Buddha, to see that control is the cause of the corruption of this deva, making him almost being like a devil. Power corrupts, but what real power is controlling. And if you control, 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 then you become like a Mara. Instead of controlling, we let things be. Instead of trying to make things this way or that way, we love them for who they are. If you're in a relationship and you try and control your partner, make her or him this way or that way, it's not much of a relationship. You're like Mara. But if you love them and let them be who they are, then that's escaping from Mara. That's like the Buddha. And the way to overcome Mara is not through fighting or more controlling. In the suttas, sometimes Mara would come and try and tempt people. You don't need to become enlightened. You can be this great prime minister, this great power. You can save so many people. You could actually help the whole world. Because it still wants to control you. But all you need to do is to say, I know you control. When you understand what controlling does, It just makes things worse. I know you. Wisdom. And then Mara just has to leave. The yogi, the meditator knows me. The meditator knows me. The meditator knows me. So you don't defeat Mara by force. You defeat just by knowing. I know you, control. That's the Mara in Buddhism. It's very, very profound and very wonderful. And you know that when you get into jhanas, they say that's the place where Mara can't go. Because in the jhanas, the deep meditation, that's when you let go so much there's no controlling left at all, no possibility of controlling. Total let go. And that's the places where Mara just can't see you, can't find you. It's interesting. So all about Mara is about control. Is there any special meditation that can be done to boost trust and courage? I often feel anxiety with others and would like to get more brave. Yep. Now look, I have to give lots of talks. And sometimes those talks are on TV. Live TV, when everybody's watching, and if you pick your nose, everybody sees it throughout the whole world. Now, many times, you know, I've had to do these jobs on live TV. I remember once, actually, I was in Sri Lanka once and had to give this live telecast, and they told me it has to be 57 minutes, not 56, not 58. You have to give a sermon all by yourself, no one else, no prompts, and you have to time it just to 57 minutes. They said, if you end early, then we won't know what to do. If you go on too late, we'll cut you off. And it was like broadcast live across Sri Lanka. And that was really a challenge. So would you get upset and anxious about that? So my method of overcoming this, which I'll teach you, is actually to have some fun. Because I realize if you're enjoying yourself and having fun, you just can't be anxious. You can't be anxious and have fun at the same time. So I just enjoy myself. Oh, this is really good. This is going to be fun. And what do we do by fun? You can go into the bathroom, first of all, and just to get yourself in the mood, look at yourself in the mirror, two fingers, and make a funny face at yourself. And straight away you laugh, because you see this stupid person in the mirror laughing at you, and you laugh as well, and that takes away all the anxiety very, very quickly. Simple method, but very powerful. And so that's what I do. Find a toilet, go in there, make a funny face of myself, and you go in front of the cameras, and here you're just so relaxed. Sometimes you make a funny face at the cameras, because you don't really care what happens. You're not getting paid for it, so it's not your career, so who cares? Then you start anxiety. And I was really quite pleased, because you know, it was a meditation on the simile of the 1,000-petal lotus. And it was timed perfectly. It just finished, you know, to the second. And it just flowed, you know, just every stage of the meditation was just right and just finished exactly. Don't need to ad-lib. It was just, I really was quite impressed about that. So anyway, that's what you can do. Not any special meditation. Do the smiling at yourself in the mirror technique. It actually works. Is it possible to meditate riddance of excess body weight, interior and exterior, problems and mind issues? What do you want to get rid of excess body weight for? It gives you a sense of gravitas. But look, it's the excess body weight is not the problem. The problem is people being miserable and upset and depressed. That's the problem. Because I read in a medical journal that people who get miserable, upset, angry, their arteries and their veins, they contract. That's what causes you the heart attacks. But if you laugh and say, sadhu, 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 your arteries actually expand. Which means it answers one of those problems, those little riddles I always want to know the answer for. Why is it that fat people are always happy and jolly? It's always the case, isn't it? Fat people are jolly people. And the reason is this. Because if you're fat and miserable, you've got all the excess cholesterol and other gut going through your system. And because you're miserable, your arteries contract. And that gives you the cardiac arrest. That kills you. So all the fat, miserable people died a long time ago. But if you're fat and happy, that means, yes, you've got extra stuff going through your veins and arteries, but it doesn't matter because you laugh so much, your arteries are twice the size of normal people, so all that stuff can go through, no trouble at all. You live a long life. So if you laugh a lot, then you can actually put on some weight. And no problem at all. You can enjoy yourself, eat nice fatty food, whatever you like to eat, but make sure you laugh a lot. That's why the only people left are the fat, happy ones. So please, laugh a lot. And that is how you get rid of, you don't get rid of excess body weight, you get rid of the bad consequences of cardiac arrest and stuff. I have been told that visualizing a pinpoint of light is a useful practice. Please comment. Right, don't believe everything you've been told. And don't even believe that either. If you don't believe what you've been told, it's a waste of time me answering it. No, it doesn't matter. Don't try and visualize a pinpoint of light. It will just give you a bit of a headache. So just allow the pinpoint of light or the lights to come up naturally. Don't try to make it happen. The Buddha taught many devas in his time, most of which should still be alive due to their long lifespan. Do monks ever cross-reference Sutta validity when any of these devas? I'm not sure what you're asking there, but yeah, there are some of the devas like Brahmasahampati. He was the one who came and asked the Buddha to teach. And according to the suttas, he was another monk in the time of the Buddha, time of the previous Buddha, because this Buddha, Gautama, Siddhartha Gautama, is the present Buddha. The previous Buddha was Kassapa, and that previous Buddha, there was other monks with Kassapa the Buddha, and our Buddha was one of the monks with Kassapa the Buddha. His name was Jyotipala. And the previous Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, was Jyotipala, a monk with Kassapa the Buddha. Also, Gatikara was a monk with Kassapa the Buddha, and also Brahmasahampati had another name, I think Kokalata or something. That was his name, or Kolia or something, with Kassapa the Buddha. He became Brahmasahampati. He's a non-returner, an anagami. And so those non-returners, in time of the Buddha, like Gatikara and Sahampati, they came, as soon as the Buddha became enlightened, it was like their old mates. They were monks together in the previous dispensation of the Buddha. So they came down to congratulate, you know, our Buddha. Well done, you've become a Buddha now. So yeah, there are some cross-referencing, you know, in the suttas, and it actually brings everything together. Makes a lot of sense to me. What is a good technique for tiredness? Yeah, work a lot, and that makes you tired. Is that what you're asking? Say, what's a good technique for tiredness? I think for overcoming tiredness, rest. I'll be having a good meditation, allowing the mind to be until it decides to partially enter a dreamlike state. No matter how much sleep I get, this seems to occur. Stay in that dreamlike state. Don't fight it. It's just a passing phase of meditation. I'll probably talk more about this later on, about how to deal with the hindrances to meditation. The sloth and torpor, the tiredness, the dreaminess, just stay there. Don't fight. Soon the energy will come back to the mind. That dreamlike tired state will dissipate, just like the early morning mist. Once the sun comes up, it burns it all out, and you'll be nice and peaceful and still. So don't worry about that. Just stay where you are. Leave it alone. It still disappears by itself. If life is good enough, work is good enough, income is good enough, can injustice be good enough, pollution be good enough, could the habituation to the good enough view become just laziness? Thanks. But laziness is good enough. Thanks. The answer to that question, that's a good enough question. Is it really injustice, though? Because this was just up the road over here is Carnot Prison Farm, and I've been teaching over there for quite a few years. When this guy came up to me, he was part of my meditation class. He's one of these old prisoners who'd been in and out of jail most of his life. And he said, can I talk to you after the session? So I said, yes. And so he talked to me, and he told me, he said, this time I've been put in jail for something I didn't do. I didn't do that robbery. It wasn't me. And he said, this is honest, Ajahn Brahm. I know that many prisoners would say that, but I know you, I respect you, I'm telling the truth. I did not do that crime. And I believed him. And I knew that when you're in jail, you get very little opportunity to have phone calls than to right injustices. That's why there've been many people who've been put in jail for a long time. It's only when some journalist or someone outside realizes an injustice has been done and they fight their case that the people in prison get out. When you're in jail, you've just got no resources. So I knew that, so I started thinking, who can I call when I get back to monastery to try and open up this man's case and get him released from jail? He's been put in jail for a thing he didn't do. When I was thinking like that, he interrupted me and he smiled. He said, "But Ajahn Brahm, there were so many other robberies where I wasn't caught. I guess this is fair." He taught me the law of karma. Because it's true, isn't it? Sometimes you're getting put in jail for something you didn't do. But how many things you did do and you got away with? So in the end, it all turns to balance. So there's a lot of things which we think are injustices. They're not injustices. It's just a balancing of the books. That's what happens. So it's interesting, the idea of injustice. So pollution is good enough. Well, it could be worse. But no, good enough is what you do when you're meditating. This is meditation retreat. This is not work. So this is the time you rest. So this is rest. This is good enough in this retreat. When you get outside, then you do the work. Otherwise, you know, ask Dania, you know, if she thinks this hall is clean enough, no, she'll work hard cleaning it up after you guys go. Ask Bianca, you know, just giving you sort of bread and water, that's good enough. Is that what you want to eat tomorrow? No. So what we do, when we're meditating, when we want to relax and let go, that is when we say good enough. When there's nothing to do, do nothing. When there's something to do, give it everything you've got. Right now, there's nothing to do. Do nothing. Later on, when you've got to clean up your room at the end of the retreat, then give it everything you've got. When it's time to go out there and work and save the world, give it everything you've got. When it's time to make a donation, give it everything you've got. But you guys will say good enough. Brahm, please help me. I'm a former Christian and fearful that storm and bushfire was the wrath of God against the heathens. It didn't work, did it? The heathens won. From the Buddhist perspective, do something. Goiter, back pain, hot flashes, anxiety, emotional pains come from the suppression of emotion. What is the best way out of this kind of suffering? Much like Ajahn. Yes, sometimes it's controlling. Instead of suppression of emotion, like controlling your emotions, like controlling anything, that causes a lot of the pain, especially in your body. So yeah, I mean, you've got sort of a sickness and you don't take a rest. You know, you've got some sort of ache in the body and you just control it and just forget about it and just try and force your way through it. And that causes the problem. You know, trying to control other people, control yourself, and be controlled by others. You stupid girl, you know, bad person, and you take that on board rather than letting it go. Then that causes many of the problems here. So the opposite of controlling is letting go. Otherwise known as love. Otherwise known as making peace. And what is love anyway? Remember that simile, opening the door of your heart. No matter what's going on. No matter what life is. No matter what you are. No matter how your meditation is. No matter what stupid monk you are. I open the door of my heart and say, Ajahn Brahm, I love you as you are. I'm never going to try and control you. Never criticize you. You can just be who you are. That's called letting go. That's also called love. They come together. And that gives rise to peace. So that way you don't get any emotional burdens anymore. Just let things be. Ajahn, pondering really heavy stuff today. Oh, what are you pondering? I am a little surprised to see how coffee and tea and goods made from sugar can be part of a monk's and nun's Buddhist lifestyle. I would have thought that if you were sobriest out, which you appear to be, you wouldn't need to indulge in these stimulants. Oh, no. Because because people offer these things to the monks, and if I don't drink them, you don't make any merit. And he goes, so, no, you give me the tea, and so out of compassion for you, I drink that tea, and I drink that coffee, and I drink that sugar, and I drink all those other things which you give to me, especially the ones I like. So you could do that. I can think, what is a monk supposed to be? And a monk always sits perfectly straight. And he never tells a joke. And he's got a horizontal mouth. Never turned up, never turned down. And you ask me a question, and I say, you should know. If that's the sort of monk you want, get a robot. But isn't it really nice? And you see monks, you see a monk like Ajahn Chah, and he was always chewing this betel nut. You know, this red stuff in his mouth. Because that's what he's brought up with. Me, you know, having tea and sugar, that's because of my parents. They conditioned me that way. That's how I grew up. I'm brainwashed. Apparently, that, you know, in England, most certainly my generation, as soon as you're off your mother's milk, you're onto the cup of tea. So, you know, it's just totally conditioned into me. So that's just who I am. It's just like, I often think, you know, my blood has probably got sort of, you know, brown with tannin and lots of tea in it. What is your take on vigorous cardio exercise and what the body and mind needs? I am a hardcore Zumba fanatic. And as much as I love to shake my tosh, I can see the benefits of slowing down. Plus, my hip has improved. Yeah, middle way, remember. So yeah, do exercise or Zumba, whatever it is, but please do a middle way. And if you're doing hard exercise, at least be mindful so you can feel your body. And if your body says enough, stop. Same with yoga. You know, when you're sort of stretching, you know, if you're mindful enough, you know, yeah, I can stretch a bit more, but not too much, because then you do yourself injury. That awareness and mindfulness must always be there, no matter what you're doing. And then you can actually feel whether it's right or wrong for you, and it won't be right for everybody. So I don't think it's, you know, a wonderful for everybody to do Zumba or Zumba, whatever it is. So, you know, if it works for you, fine, go for it. Does insight need to come after 2 or 3 hours of meditation? Nope. Can disappearing of figures come in a few minutes of closing eyes? Yes. Can't light also come in a few moments of closing the eyes? Sometimes. All the talk and images in meditation are the same as in dreams? No. We're running out of time, so. Are they part of our past life experience? No. If not, who are they? Are they just images which come up? My own imagination? Sometimes it's imagination just on a core of truth. My own self talking, my own wisdom. Let them go, be happy. Indeed, everything is impermanent in ourself. When I do something more about insight later on in this retreat, and the things which come up in the mind during meditation, I'll also talk about that later on during the retreat. So I don't want to dishonor this question. I will talk about this in more depth later on. I've just got to go through a few. A little slower. Coming in. Yeah. No, I'll talk about this later. They were asking about many, many questions about meditation, which, because we've got, I'm trying to get ahead of the game. So, if you want to be the last here, and I'll tell you at the very end. You once told a story about two men who went to look for a treasure. One man brought back some gold while the other man brought back some hemp. I think the moral of the story is to teach us not to attach to old stuff when new and better stuff are available. However, when I attach to old things, I usually think I'm being frugal and content. Often other people have to point out that for me before I can make a change. Can you explain how I can examine this false contentment from the real ones? This was a story of the Buddha. Two men went to look for some treasure, and they both found some hemp, and then they made a bundle of the hemp, and then they went further, and someone found some hemp cloth. And they exchanged the hemp for the hemp cloth. The other one said, no, this is good enough for me. And then the other one exchanged the hemp cloth for some cotton, and then some cotton cloth, and then some silver, and then some gold. There's a whole series of things. One said, oh, no, this is enough for me, and kept the hemp. And the other one changed when he got something better. And eventually the one came back with the gold, the other one came back with some lousy hemp. And it was the Buddha was saying, it's okay to be frugal and content materially, but you know, in life, if you see something better, a better way of meditating, a better way of doing something, then do it. So don't get attached, especially to views and opinions and practices. If you find a better way of doing it, do it. Otherwise, there's no real growth and progress. So I say that, you know, this, and even in the traditions of Buddhism, yeah, the traditions are really wonderful, but there's a better way of bowing, there's a better way of having a Buddha statue, a better way of building a monastery, a better way of having Sangha, monks and nuns. Yeah, keep the traditions if you can, but you can adapt to modern times. So that's actually why it's good to adapt. You keep a lot of precepts, but unlike many people and monks who are tense and strict, you are very loose, relaxed and kind. Can you explain how to be relaxed and kind while maintaining self-discipline? What actually is self-discipline? You know, what is the purpose of self-discipline? Self-discipline is learn how to be kind, how to be relaxed and loose. What are you disciplining yourself for? What's the purpose of that discipline? To find peace, wisdom, kindness and compassion. Please, no, don't confuse the path with the goal. The path is the goal. So if you're kind, if you're loose, relaxed, that is the goal. It shows you're letting go. You're not carrying things. You're not getting angry. Some people think you've got to shout at people to get them to meditate. What type of meditation is that? It just makes people upset and angry. That's no way to meditate. The path is the goal. So if the goal is to have this beautiful sense of compassion and being at peace with the whole world, letting go of things, you do it now. The goal is the path. So if you're loose, kind, compassionate, free, that is the path to being loose, compassionate, kind and free. That is self-discipline. Or rather, no self-discipline. And no self. What is the singing bowl used for? It's used for singing. Why is that when I go to meditate, all that seems to happen lately is sleep? Because you're tired. So have more naps during the day if you meditate. So first few days, you're allowed to sleep as much as you like. And if you're meditating and you get dull, just allow yourself to get dull. Don't fight it. It means your nature is telling you you've worked your brain too hard and you need a rest. It's nature. So just, you know, take a rest, take a break. Later on in the retreat, you know, you'll come good. So be patient. Reading Richard Shankman's book, Experience of Samadhi, it seemed different teachers, all meditation masters, had different and contradictory descriptions of what jhanas feel like. Is it possible that different people's minds are different, so different experiences of samadhi jhana is natural? Or should there be some basic features of jhana that are felt by everyone? Could it be that your descriptions of jhana in your book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, are specific to your experience, but other meditators may experience it differently, e.g. no still hearing or feeling the body in first jhana? Thank you. Sorry? You have to sharpen your ears up to be have faster ears. Okay, talking about basically the jhanas. Later on in this retreat, I will also talk about these deep meditations of jhanas. When you're so still and peaceful, you can't feel your body. Now, some people say you can feel the body in jhanas. It doesn't really matter, but you still have to get to that state when the body totally disappears. Don't know what you want to call it. I call that jhanas. Body totally disappeared. You can't hear, you can't feel. And you're perfectly still. And I will show why that's really important to get the deep insights. I say that's jhanas, other people say not. I have a very high standard for jhanas. I think that's an accurate standard. Other people dumb it down and make it much easier. They're much more popular because it's very tough getting Ajahn Brahm to say you've got a jhana, but these other monks, go to this other monk over there, this other teacher. It's much easier to get jhanas with him. So sometimes it is true. It's just like sometimes that I keep very high standards of meditation. Some people say it's too high standards, but I still keep those high standards. To get, say, a degree in some universities, you've got to be very smart and work hard. Other universities, it's very easy. So the standard of the degree, you may still call it jhana, but the standard of jhanas here is very high. Do you believe in free will? Not at all. It costs a lot of money. Later on I was saying, no, what you thought was free will was not free at all. Totally conditioned. I will let you know later on, it's okay now because you've been here 2 days. You've already been totally brainwashed over the last 2 or 3 days. So all the things you say and you do, it's not your choice anymore. I've already got into your brain and brainwashed you and conditioned you. It's going to happen there. Just like this story of this monk. And he was having a hard time getting enough funds to pay for his temple. And so he went to see another monk and said, look, how can I raise more funds for the temple? Because it's really hard to make ends meet. And the other monk, who'd been in the business a long time, he said, it's very simple. The next time you give a sermon, close all the windows in the temple. Close the doors and turn up the heating. Make it very stuffy and hot. And when you give your sermon, give a very boring sermon in a monotone. So boring and so monotonous that everybody in the audience starts to fall asleep. And just before they fall asleep, get out your watch. That's why I have one of these for. Swing it backwards and forwards. Hypnotize anybody. And once they're all hypnotized, you tell them, no more coins in the donation box. No more fives or tens or twenties. Only fifties and hundreds. I said, I can't do that. That's fraud, said this young monk. I said, no, no. That's encouraging people to make good karma. So he tried it. The next day he gave a sermon. Turned up the heating. Gave a boring sermon in a monotone. And when everyone was about to fall asleep, he got out his watch. Hypnotized everybody. And gave them the suggestion, when you leave, no coins, no fives, no tens, no twenties, only fifties and hundreds in the donation box, everyone. And then he took them out of hypnosis. And then when they left, the donation box was stuffed with fifties and hundreds. He cleaned up. He made a fortune. But that paid his bills for quite a few weeks. But he thought, if I do that every week, soon they'll suss me out. And I won't be able to do it anymore. So he waited about 3 or 4 weeks. Needed a bit more cash. Tried the same trick again. Closed all the windows. Turned up the heater. Gave a very boring sermon. When they're about to fall asleep, he got his watch out again. They're just about to be hypnotized. And he dropped his watch. And he said, shit. And it took them 2 weeks to clean the church. Okay, that's not the way to raise funds for the temple. So, no such thing as free will. You're totally conditioned. Quickly, what's the relationship between mindfulness and kindness? Does mindfulness naturally have an embedded kindness? Because this is a very deep question. I'll leave this till tomorrow. This is a very profound question. Dear Ajahn, there are not enough cushions. There are only 60. We need 180 more meditation cushions. No, many of you have got your own cushions. It's called fat bottoms. Those with fat bottoms don't use the cushions. Leave them for people who've got thin bottoms. Have you ever noticed why traditional Buddhist temples, the wooden floors are always shiny? Yes, well, you know that. I told you that before. Because in Buddhist temples, everybody sits on the floor, and especially many of the elderly women and men who've got fat bottoms, and when they fidget, that's where they polish the floor. And that's where you go into these ancient temples in Japan and even Thailand, and they're very highly polished floors. Lots of bottoms have done that. Fidgeting over hundreds of years. So, you know, we're only starting this course, so we need a lot more polishing, please. No, it's okay. You can only get so many cushions. So, you know, just, you know, get whatever you've got and bring your own cushions. And just, you know, but please know none of those whoopee cushions. I was always afraid that someone put one of those down on my seat and I sit down and it makes a bad noise. But, yeah, you've got cushions, got the chairs. That should be enough. If anyone wants to offer some more, fine. You can always offer some more. Okay, the one about kindness, I'm going to leave that till tomorrow. So thank you. That's all the questions. I went over a little bit longer because I was running out of time. So that's the question for this evening. I hope you enjoyed it. The night is still young. It's only 9:30. And what time do you usually go to bed when you're at home? Sometimes 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock. Especially you young guys. Sometimes you don't go to bed till 4 o'clock in the morning, but on retreat, 9 o'clock, you're fast asleep. Whatever, anyway. So please enjoy yourself. If you feel like meditating, meditate. If you feel like sleeping, sleep. So just be mindful of your body. Be kind to your body. And if that's what you need to do, do it. Okay, now to end up the day. Are you ready? Here it comes. Sadhu. 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 One crazy monk.